This is a special note to the listener regarding this episode. The only requirement to speak on Keep Coming Back is to be an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Alex absolutely fits that condition. However, part of his journey includes drug use, which is discussed in this share. If that's something that triggers you or something you are not interested in, please skip this episode. We post a new one every Thursday, and thank you for listening. We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
All right, my name is Alex B. My sobriety date is November 8th, 2016. Wow. So, might first start this by saying I've kind of been coming to Alcoholics Anonymous my entire life due to the fact that my grandparents were heavily involved in the program. They had their trials and tribulations growing up in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, raising three kids. And actually, it was my grandmother who first went to Al-Anon due to my grandfather's drinking, Bob and Pauline B. Both heavily involved in the church and brought up Christian and died Christians. My grandmother was just sick and tired of my grandfather's drinking, and they had a counselor, but it would only work or keep my grandfather from drinking for like a few weeks at a time, and then he'd start drinking again. So my grandmother made it to an Alano club and started working the program in Al-Anon. Not Alano club, but Al-Anon. And my grandfather got sick and tired of seeing his luggage on the porch. And my grandmother stopped covering up for him and calling his place of employment and lying for him. And so he finally surrendered to this thing and went back to that same counselor who suggested that he try Alcoholics Anonymous, and he got sober and worked the steps. And they actually wrote this incredible book and started this incredible program called Overcomers Outreach, which was before Celebrate Recovery. Celebrate Recovery is the 12 steps with Jesus as the higher power. So before that, they had Overcomers Outreach. And it was put into play not to replace Alcoholics Anonymous, but a bridge for the church and AA, for both sides, for anyone that in Alcoholics Anonymous who felt that their higher power was Jesus, they could come there also. And then anyone in the church who was struggling with alcohol could also find their way to the program. Because back in the day, people in church were, if you were drinking, it was pretty much frowned upon. So this was just an incredible thing that they started, and they actually were on the Dr. James Dobson's radio show, which is awesome. It's online. Check it out. It's pretty cool. But back to my story. That's just kind of the beginning of it. My brother and I have an identical twin brother. We're both 36. We have an older sister, Katie, who's 7 years older than us. And just remember growing up and feeling like it was a normal life, not knowing that one day I would walk through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous wanting to get help, or needing to get help, really. My brother and I would go on these camping trips with our grandparents in their Pace Aero RV camper, and we would go up the coast from California to Washington State and back. And my grandparents pretty much raised us as far as spirituality is concerned, you know, was praying at the dinner table, and my grandfather always talking about how he was an alcoholic, and just thinking that that was their thing, that was their bag, and that was normal. And they were very much the rock in our immediate family. We would go to church and with my parents and my sister and my brother on like once a month. It was like something we were trying, you know, trying to fit in with normal families that would go to church, but we definitely weren't, or I wasn't all sold on the whole Jesus thing. I just kind of acted as if, and you're kind of born into your religion. And so just, yeah, growing up in Westminster, California, with a twin brother, and we had that twin gimmick, and we were immediately popular just because we were twins. My sister hated it. 7 years later, she's this center of attention, and then these two twins come out. Poor thing. So all the attention was taken off of her. And we're also like an entertainment family. My father, Bob, was in bands all over California, and then would perform on the weekends in Palm Springs for like a decade. So he wasn't necessarily around all the time, but my mother was perfection to us. She would, you know, she did everything that she could for us. And there was some definite adult situations that we were put into when we were growing up. This is even before drinking, just stuff that was a little heavy. And so it was kind of hard to process some of the emotions and feelings that we had growing up, not really sure on what or how to deal with them, just kind of getting on with it and going through life. And the first time I drank was in China, and I was 17 years old. I went to a performing arts high school at Huntington Beach High School. They had an academy for performing arts there. And the school felt that if we traveled, it would be good for our craft. And so we went to Ireland, we went to England, New York City, and China was one of the stops. And that's when I was 17. And if you can see over the bar in China, you can drink. So that's where kind of my drinking career began. And I should have known I was an alcoholic from day one, because as soon as I took a sip of alcohol, I didn't have an off switch. I just remember embarrassing myself that entire week, but still loving it and thinking I was having fun. I had alcohol poisoning on the flight home. And the flight from China home was like 17 hours, so it was awful. And I think I was in a window seat, so just having to get up and ask people to get out of the way so I could go to the bathroom. I was just awful. And then I graduated in 2005. So around that time of my high school career, opiates were a huge thing. The OxyContin, there's two great movies out right now that really do a great job at depicting what was really going on with OxyContin. One's called Dope Sick with Michael Keaton, and the other one's called Painkillers with Matthew Broderick. Two incredible shows. One's on Hulu, the other's on Netflix. Check it out. But really, it's just like looking into people's medicine cabinets and finding these pills. I can remember my first experience with opiates, not necessarily me taking it, but seeing it. Someone had come to school, and they had taken a fistful of OxyContin. And he was talking about how if someone were to kick him in the shin right now, he wouldn't feel it. And I just remember thinking, I wonder what that's about. And then we just somehow, I really can't even remember how or where we got the pills, but they were just around, and we would take like three or four with like a Red Bull, and we would have high Mondays, we'd call it. This is in high school. And no addiction really has started yet. This is just the door, you know, the beginning of drinking and drugging. So just really experimenting by doing it on the weekends or doing the pills when we would find it. And then I was fortunate enough to get accepted into the American Musical Dramatic Academy in Manhattan, New York. I'd always wanted to travel. I always wanted to live like outside of California. And so I kind of left everyone behind. My brother really hated that I'd left him and broke up our little band, as you could call it, our little 18 years of living in the same room and wearing the same clothes and, you know, going to high school together. So I went to New York City and went to the school there. And yeah, it's just, I did not take it seriously at all. I wish I would have, looking back on it, but I was 20 and just wanted to have fun. I had so much fun and still did my schoolwork, but it was mainly just about me being on my own, living in my own little dorm room. And I had some recording equipment. I would just lock myself in there and record. And I would drink on the weekends. And still, every time I would drink, it would be like to sickness, but still not drinking every day. So I was out there for about 2.5 years. And then I finally came back to California. Should have stayed in New York and auditioned. I think I went to one audition and got really close, and they decided to go with someone else. And I was just so young and naive, and my ego was so big, I kind of gave New York City the bird and said, well, then I'm out of here. And I flew back to California, and I had no plan. I had no plan whatsoever. I didn't know what I was going to do. I mean, I've got all this musical theater and entertaining schooling. And then my next door neighbor started up this company, this real estate company, where I was doing data entry, getting paid pretty well and just making money. And my brother had just auditioned to be in this show called Jesus Christ Superstar, where he was playing Jesus. And my new best friend, he was my best friend then, but he's now my best friend. And they did this show. And this guy we met was 35, and he was at the end of his drinking. So he knew how to party. He lived in Long Beach, and we would hang out and stay at his apartment all the time. And he kind of just taught us how to smoke weed. He taught us how to do MDMA. And the three of us just partied really hard. And we used to put this like strobe light on his table, and we would walk around in circles chasing each other, listening to Usher and like trippy music. And police officers would come by all the time, knock on the door, and they would look in and they'd be like, is it just you guys in here? And listening to all the old records by the Beatles, Jim Morrison, all the people we looked up to musically that we wanted to be. And I just kind of got lost in this weird experiment of drugs and alcohol. My friend eventually got evicted because we were being so loud. I mean, we would be blasting music at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he finally got an eviction notice, and we had to move across town. And it was in a horrible part of town. Parking was just awful. And somewhere in there, my brother was working for South Coast Repertory, which is a great acting program here in California. And he had somehow wandered upon heroin. And I think he wasn't too scared of it, because we were really into like Jim Morrison and a band called Ween that was always talking about opium and Down with the Brown. So I'm sure he was just intrigued and fascinated, and he started smoking heroin without any of us knowing. I was throwing this party. I was house sitting for a friend, and we were drinking, and this friend brought over some pot cookies, really strong pot cookies. Like, I would eat a corner of it and just be floored. And I was watching this guy's dog in this house having a great party. Everyone left. I had like 4 packs of these awesome cookies that I was going to save, and went to bed, got up in the morning. Everyone was gone. I walked out into the living room looking around, and I see those packs of the cookies and they're empty. I'm like, what the hell is going on? Did someone, I look over, the dog is just in the corner looking at me. And he starts like twitching, like having a seizure or something. And I'm like, oh my God, I've killed this dog. What am I going to do? And then I hear a knock at the door and it's my brother. I'm like, okay, I'm not going to say anything. If Matthew doesn't notice anything about the dog, I should be okay. So Matt comes in. And we sit down, and the first thing he says is, what's wrong with the dog? I start freaking out. I'm like, I have these cookies, they're strong as hell. He starts freaking out, and he runs into the bathroom, and I hear him, like, yelling. And then he comes out, and he's like, here, smoke this. It's opium. Now, he knew to say opium and not heroin, because heroin would freak me out. But opium was something that Ween was really into. And so I was like, oh, opium. This is just like my favorite band, Gene and Dean Ween. I'm gonna smoke opium like they did. So I smoked some, didn't really feel it on the first hit, and then the second hit I started going, oh, this is great. And the heroin thing, so my alcoholism and drug addiction wasn't necessarily an addiction, it was just more of a habit, you know, drink every night, smoke every night. But with the heroin, it was the same thing, just kind of here and there. And then it became this kind of routine, this everyday thing, you know, make sure you have the foil in your pocket, make sure you find some pens, and, you know, take them apart, put the little tube in your pocket. And, you know, we were listening to Ween and we were chasing the dragon. My brother and I are in a band, so we started writing songs about all this stuff. And we wrote a song called My New Addiction, which is about chasing the dragon, and really just kind of in this, like, this party time and just having fun. Like, it was fun. It didn't seem like we were doing anything wrong. We were just kind of working at this real estate company, making good money and partying at night with our friend Matt. And then one day I don't know why, maybe I just ran out of money or the Connect didn't pick up, but I wasn't able to score. I wasn't able to pick up. And so I was like, okay, I won't pick up. So I'm going about my day, and a few hours go by, and I start to feel sick. I'm like, oh, great. Coming down with a cold. This is the last thing that I need right now. So I think, what can help a cold? Heroin could help a cold. Yeah, let's get some heroin. That'll make me feel good. So I score. I get some heroin. I smoke the first hit. The cold is gone. The sickness is gone. And it hit me. I was like, oh no. Am I addicted to this? I started talking to my drug dealer like, hey, I was sick before this. And like my legs were really jittery. But I thought I was sick. What's going on? He was like, oh, you're kicking. Yeah. You're kicking from not having the dope. And I felt like this door slammed, like a jail cell. Immediately, I was like, oh no, I'm tethered to this thing. We had this drug dealer who lived off of PCH near Main Street over by this like factory, like this, I don't know what kind of stuff they were making, but it's on PCH. And if you keep going towards Newport Beach past Main Street on the left-hand side, there's like this little factory, this little, whatchamacallit, like a mobile park. This guy, Greg, he lived there, and he knew we were naive to drugs, to heroin. And he was upcharging us like, oh, there's no way I can keep up with this. I mean, financially, and I mean, it got pretty scary. Luckily, we met another drug dealer that he was picking up from. Luckily, this drug dealer, Greg, didn't have transportation, so we'd have to drive to Long Beach, pick up from this girl named Cassie. And I don't know how or when this happened, but Cassie pulled us aside one day, and she was like, you know, he's upcharging you guys like $20. Like, and we were like, what? So we got rid of him, and we started getting more heroin, because now we had enough money to buy what we needed. So it was just a slippery slope. My brother definitely was the first one to graduate towards using a needle. And he started shooting heroin. And in the beginning, we couldn't do it ourselves. We couldn't shoot up ourselves. We had to have other people do it. So we'd have like our drug dealer, Greg, do it, or we'd have to try and do it for ourselves. We were amateurs. You know, we didn't read the instructions. We had no idea heroin was addictive. We had no idea that, how to use a needle and how to cook it up and everything. So we weren't just tethered to the drug, but we were tethered to these drug dealers who were showing us how to do it. And so that was a process of, you know, a few months of having to deal with them and until we figured out how to do it on our own. And at that time, I had also picked up like a teaching job, and I was working at a summer school teaching like music and acting. And so I couldn't shoot into my arms. I had to shoot into my feet, which was pretty uncomfortable. And so there was a lot of just bleeding and missing the mark, and not much alcohol is for me during this time. For me, opiates and alcohol were a horrible combination. I would always get violently ill if I drank on Vicodin or Oxycontin or heroin. But for some reason, my brother, my friend Matt, could always drink and mix the stuff. I didn't have the stomach for it. Anyways, at this time, my mother, God bless her soul, had been diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, which is basically, there's no known cure. It's a 3 to 5 year lifespan. And what happens is your brain just stops sending motor functions to your body. And piece by piece by piece, you shut down. And the first thing to go for her was her speech. And so we had to get her an iPad that she would communicate with us with, like a Stephen Hawking voice, you know, that computer Siri voice. So that was disturbing. So on top of us having a horrible heroin addiction, and everyone knew we were addicted to heroin, my parents, my whole family, I was getting fired left and right from jobs, and everyone was calling me and freaking out, like, what are you doing? You got to get off that shit. And, you know, how do you get off that shit? And she's dying. And, you know, I think we had some experience of Alcoholics Anonymous due to my grandparents, and I somehow figured out a way to get into treatment. My grandparents were able to get me, well, not my grandparents, my grandfather died in 2006 of a heart attack. And so it was just my grandma. She would let us come and stay with her when the heat was just getting too hot. And she figured out a way to get me into this incredible treatment center called Pacific Hills. It's called Covenant Hills now. But I just wasn't ready. I didn't understand the 12 steps. It was Chinese to me, honestly. I just started acting like I knew what I was doing. Like I was back at the American Musical Dramatic Academy, just like pretending like I know what I was doing. I think I was trying to sponsor guys in the house too, which was crazy. And I ended up relapsing on Xanax and back to heroin. And it was just awful, horrible, the dark ages of my life. Just always being sick and only being high every now and again, and trying to keep it from everybody, and trying to cover up my arms and cover up my eyes so that people couldn't see how pinned out my eyes were. Luckily, shortly after my mom, she did end up passing in 2011, and that was horrific in itself, you know, having them come pick her up and put her in that black plastic bag and zipping it up and on the stretcher and pushing her out to a van, and just a traumatic, awful, horrible experience. My mom was Christmas to us. She made everything seem so special. So for her to be gone was like the end of my life. Luckily, my brother and I were able to go to AA and stay sober for like 30 days. I think she died when we both had 30 days of sobriety, and we went to a meeting and we stood up with 30 days. We shared, saying, you know, my mom died today, but I'm sober. But really, we were white knuckling it. We weren't in the steps. We didn't have sponsors. We were just going to meetings because we didn't know what to do. We didn't understand that there was action that had to be taken. So fast forward after that, I think we relapsed the next day, 31 days, 32 days. And we just continued just destroying each other. He would get sober. I would get high. I would get sober. He would get high. And we were just using my friend Matt's place to do this dirty business. And it just got sicker and darker and sicker and darker. luckily, I don't even know how I did this, but I was able to score some incredible job with this entertainment company that was doing this like Michael Jackson show. And I was able to leave California and kind of get away from the heroin scene. And I just continued doing these different tribute shows of Elton John and Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons and casinos and hotels. And I took the disease basically on the road. And it's so true what they say. Moving away from your scene of doing drugs and alcohol is not the solution. Because I found opiates and I found all that shit everywhere I went. I was the magnet. I was the person who could find it. And it just... that was my specialty, my expertise. I ended up in South Carolina, of all places, so random, doing this Frankie Valli show in Myrtle Beach. And I was just, I became a raging alcoholic, just constantly drinking and drinking during the show. And just, I mean, I did that show there for like 3 years, 4 years or 5 years, something like that. In the midst of that, I met my wife, who wasn't my wife then, of course. She was actually engaged to be married to some other man. And she was a dancer. I was a singer. And we met, and it was just kind of over from day one. And I knew I was going to lose her, though. I knew I was going to lose her if I didn't do something about my drinking. So I think I started auditing AA again and dipping my toe in it. I would go on Tuesdays. I found this guy named Jerry who had gotten sober when he was 18. He had like 20 years. He would come and pick me up and take me to AA. And I would just kind of go and not drink that day. And that would kind of be like, okay, I'm not drinking on Tuesday. This is good. I've got control of this thing. Sometimes I would drink when I got home on those Tuesdays. So it wasn't a very good effort until finally, after partying and partying like I was 20 years old, like back when I was in school, yeah, I was just blowing through my money. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, in 2016, this hurricane, Hurricane Matthew, came and destroyed the theater I was working at. Literally, like, just knocked it out of commission, and it flooded, and it was just not a place of business anymore. I got a letter from the producer saying, basically this stamp that he sent out to every performer that worked for him saying, as of this moment, you're terminated. It was a very formal stamp that I could tell he was just, he was probably freaking out too. I mean, his theater had just been destroyed, but I was just such a sensitive, egomaniac, alcoholic. I wanted a phone call or something. So I went into a spiral, just a horrible spiral for like 2 weeks until finally I just said, I can't do this anymore. I was looking at my bank account. The money was gone. I have no income. I know about AA. It's my only hope. I know it's my only hope. I know it's the only thing that's going to save me from this thing. Not Jesus, who I thought was that I did believe in, but I would pray to Jesus and I would pray to God. Nothing worked, but I knew AA could work because my brother had gotten sober about 5 years before this. And so did my friend Matt. And so I had tangible evidence that the 12 steps were working in people's lives, people that I were close to. I would just call them in blackouts, and I would call them and say, what do I do? And finally, just on November 7th, 2016, I surrendered and I said, this is it. This is the last night. That next day, I went to a meeting, and so much social anxiety as one has when they're trying to get sober. It's found in Alano Club in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. It's an incredible club. We've got meetings all day. I was lucky enough to find like a happy hour meeting at 5:30 with some old timers, and I was able to reconnect with Jerry, who got me really plugged in with a lot of the younger people. And I just got into the middle, into the work, into the solution. And I got hungry for the 12 steps, and I got hungry for meetings, and I got hungry for Bill and Bob, and like a new kid in school. Like, this was my new thing to study. And in that process, I was able to land a get well job at this cafe called Kind Belly, which was like one of my favorite restaurants in Myrtle Beach. The food's just absolutely incredible. And I just worked the register, made wraps, dishwashed, did all that stuff, and started getting my milestones, started helping out with the coffee, got a secretary commitment, and just did what I was told to do. And I remember when I got a year of sobriety, they say, how did you do it? And I said, by taking suggestions. Because truly, that's how I got sober, was listening to other people's ideas and doing what I was told. Because it wasn't my idea to get sober, and it wasn't, and there was no idea that I had before that was helping me stay sober. Nothing worked but these 12 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember feeling for the first time in recovery after I did my fifth step, this euphoria, this high, because for the first time in my life, I wasn't alone with my own thoughts. And this man just listened to everything that I had to say. And I didn't leave one damn thing off my fourth step, because they said, if you left anything off your fourth step, you might drink or use again. And I didn't want that to be the case for me. So I just, like Chunk and the Goonies, just spewed my guts out with everything that I'd ever done. And it was so freeing. It was so freeing. And I remember going back to my apartment after that, because it says in the book to revisit the first five concepts, the first five steps. And have we left anything off the list that we should discuss with our sponsor at once? And I really had told him everything. And that first year was a war. But those milestones were so helpful. The 30 days and the 60 days and the 90 days. I really fought for those chips. Now, when I got my first year chip, I heard people say to me all the time, don't act like you've graduated from this thing. And that's exactly what I did, even though I said I wouldn't. I took my foot off the gas and I learned what one day at a time means in the wrong way, in the very wrong way. Talks about on page 86 in the big book, having had just made conscious contact with God, it is not probable that we are going to be inspired at all times. We might pray for this presumption. We might pay for this presumption and all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. And boy, did I. I mean, how much nicotine can I ingest? How much caffeine? You know, just anything and everything before you relapse, I tried it. Anything but the power of God and finishing the steps, I tried it. I had finished the steps, but stopped working the steps. It's the same thing. Like, the steps start over every day. Every day I have to work on this spiritual program of action. I can't just be like, oh, I'm going to take Sunday off and just do my own thing. Easier said than done. But that second year of recovery, oh my God, I got back into performing and I found another show. I got a residency at the Harris Casino in Reno doing the Frankie Valli show, and I didn't do a damn thing but that show. And then just darkness, absolute darkness, cut off from the spirit of the light. No meetings, no program. Luckily, I got plugged back in after that show. I think I was just done with performing, and I found a job at this place called Newfound Life in Long Beach, which is a residential treatment program. And I needed to be surrounded with recovery, not just by the job, but also I needed to get plugged back into the meetings. And I found this amazing guy, Tony S., who was my sponsor. And we read the book cover to cover. And we would just go to meetings. We would read the book and I would run everything by him. This is what I did. This is what I'm thinking. And we would just, that was just the consistent routine for some time. And it was just so awesome getting plugged in and at all these great meetings at Long Beach, the fights at Marina Pacifica, under the bridge, Marina Pacifica on Friday nights, MWA and Signal Hill. And it's just been a lot of trial and tribulation of trying to chase that power, the new buzz, which is recovery, and the new buzz, which is a higher power of my own understanding. Because if you don't have drugs and alcohol as a power, you have to have something in its place. And the only way to get to the power of recovery is to do the steps daily, one day at a time. And so without that, you're irritable and disconnected from everything. So there has to be a buzz. There has to be either solution or drugs. So if you're not doing the work, that's why they say if you don't grow, you go. So I just kind of been going through these phases of outgrowing my spiritual condition, you know, getting to a certain point in my recovery and then kind of just staying there too long. Like, why don't you get a sponsee now instead of just it being you? Okay, I'll get a sponsee. Get a sponsee, do the steps over, and then getting stale again. And it's just this constant growing that I'm just now realizing at 7 years that it just you just have to keep growing in order to stay. And I got to start finding new meetings, and I got to keep finding the newcomer who is the most important person. I still got to take commitments, be available, answer my phone. And another thing that's brand new for me is this power of my own understanding. And for everyone, it's their own understanding. And that's what's so great about Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's inclusive. It's about whatever is going to help you. And I think what I had been struggling with is the own understanding. I just haven't had an understanding. I've had this, you know, being brought up Christian and then coming into AA and me trying to form my own understanding of a higher power. Just creating these things in my mind that would work, but not really work. And I think for the first time ever in recovery, I finally have a higher power of my own understanding. And this is brand new to me. This just happened like a month ago, where I finally am claiming Jesus is my higher power. And that doesn't have to be your higher power. It could be whatever you want. But for me, something clicked where I felt back at home, and I started to understand what my grandparents were talking about. And now I'm getting like I was in recovery in the beginning. I'm getting excited about my higher power, and I'm starting to learn and research. But man, do I screw this thing up on a daily basis. God, I don't drink or drug, but man, do I still get impatient? I still get ego heavy. I still get angry. And there lies the progress. There lies I know that there's more work that needs to be done on a daily basis. And that I think the most difficult thing that people in recovery have to deal with, including myself, is finding how can we make this feel like a new experience each day. Because a routine is very big in recovery, your home group and your meetings and your fellowship. But if there isn't a new experience each morning when you get up and, you know, on awakening, we think about the 24 hours a day and we get right with our God and we fill up that spiritual tank, and you know, we wake up with untreated alcoholism and I have to treat it by getting right with God. If I don't do that every day and find that newness and excitement about today, it can get really stale pretty quickly. So there is so much still that I need to learn and still that I need to work on, but I'm not drinking and drugging. And what's interesting is when I was drinking and drugging, I wasn't looking for God. I wasn't trying to practice principles. And so, yeah, I may still not be where I need to be, but man, have I come so far from what it used to be. Like, I used to be a slave to drugs and alcohol. And because of AA and the 12 steps, I am a free man. I can go anywhere. I can do anything as long as I don't drink or drug. And that was not the case. That was not the case. Today, I'm married. I have a dog. I have a little apartment. I work in treatment at Newfound Life. And luckily, I'm still able to perform. I still work for an entertainment company, and I'm a guest entertainer on cruise ships. And they have AA meetings on cruise ships. They've got like a designated hour for friends of Bill W. And I try to go to those when I'm not stuck in my head or in the maze. But yeah, I mean, when I look at my life today, it's a lot more simple today than it used to be. I have to constantly remind myself, okay, you're trying to control the day. You're trying to manipulate people into doing what you want to do. Like, remember, God's the director. God's in charge today. You're probably getting upset because you have expectations, which are premeditated resentments. Like, go with the flow. My grandparents used to always say, go with the flow. I used to hate it when they said that. And now I so understand what that means. It's just get out of the way and just kind of let the day happen and take the focus off yourself and put it on to other people, because most of the time it's on me. Most of the time the focus is on me. And they always say that, you know, your wildest dreams will come true in recovery and in sobriety. And I used to think that that meant, okay, so I'm going to be rich and famous and I'm going to have a huge house and a beautiful car. But no, a wild dream for an alcoholic addict like me would be to have peace of mind. And that's what I have today. Like, I'm able to, at night, go to sleep and close my eyes, and my mind is free of worry, is free of shame and guilt. And I have peace today, which is absolutely priceless. I mean, look at all these people that have fame and fortune, and they're not happy. I mean, what's that guy's name? Anthony Ourdain or whatever his name was. He used to go around and do all the food stuff. That guy killed himself going around eating all these exotic foods and all these incredible places, lots of money, and that guy's gone. So many others. And so it's really like, it's not about the materialistic things. It's really about my soul and my connection with God, which is so weird that I'm talking about, like, for someone like me to like say the things that I'm saying about God and Jesus. And it's just so foreign to me, because I used to think those people were so lame, honestly. Like, all those people in church with their hands raised, I'm like, what a bunch of losers. And especially with the whole God thing, I mean, I can't tell you how easily influenced I am by, I mean, doubt is a cancer. I mean, there's been so much doubt in my life about what's happening in our lives and in this universe. And I feel like finally I'm just all in with this concept of God that I have. And it's just so much easier when you finally decide what it is that your higher power is, and that you finally understand what direction to go into. But also with recovery, it keeps that door open for open-mindedness about spirituality. And it's not about religion. It's really just about, these principles lead us into a really great spiritual place, giving back to others. Love and tolerance being our code is so important. I don't want to turn anyone off from Alcoholics Anonymous ever. It is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. It is the coolest thing that I have going for me today. And without it, I would have nothing. I go 1-2 days without, you know, talking to an alcoholic or thinking about the big book or thinking about doing the steps or practicing these principles. And I start getting weird. I start getting nutty, and I need it, because without AA, I lose that power of my higher power. I lose the God. AA and the 12 steps, it's like a how to find God for dummies. Something that God knew that I needed so desperately. And I'm just so grateful to be sober. I just can't believe that I'm a free man. It's all because of this movement, Alcoholics Anonymous, which is free. And I thank you so much for asking me to share and my experience, strength, and hope. I may have been thinking about myself during that whole entire time, but there's something about sharing your experience, strength, and hope, whether it's on a panel or with a newcomer or at a meeting, that at the end of it, you realize like how horrible it was in the beginning and how much the steps really do work, because of how far you come in recovery if you do this thing on the daily. So thanks for letting me share. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Alex. I really appreciate when somebody has a strong program and gratitude for the program and they share on here. Sometimes when someone shares, they're not in a strong place of their program. You give and take, and you talked about it when after you got your first year, you kind of moved a bit away from the program, and it sounds like you're really close to it right now. Can you talk about that moment when you were in Reno, which, sorry for people that live in Reno, but it has kind of a really heavy energy there. It's just, I live not very far from Reno, and I mean, far enough, but I don't go there because it's, I don't know, it's a casino town and it's hookers and drinking and it's a desert and it's all those things that can be dark for somebody trying to or early in sobriety. So what happened? Like, what literally happened to get you back into the rooms? Because you said you weren't in meetings at all when you were there.
No, I found a meeting out there, but I went like once or twice. There's a great meeting hall out there, and I'm sure there's great recovery. It's so weird. It's like, every town, every city, yeah, you can find the dark or you can find the light. Aww. I was looking for the dark. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I was anything but what happened was I made the decision to take a break from performing, and for some reason God led me to treatment, and I found Newfound Life, which is an incredible residential program in Long Beach. It's been there for 30 years, and I was really looking for a good treatment center because there's a lot of bad treatment centers out there. There's a lot of treatment centers that and detoxes that do this thing that's called cash for bodies, and it's all about the money, and I did not want to be a part of anything like that. And luckily, I still had some people that were over at Pacific Hills or Covenant Hills that I was in touch with, and I asked them about Newfound Life, and they were like, that's a great program. They're 12-step based, big on the big book. And I was like, okay, I'm down. And so just, you know, I started at the bottom there as a house manager, and now I'm like, you know, working side by side with the owners, which is awesome. And I think that sponsorship and really just getting busy with a routine of reading the big book and practicing the steps. I mean, this thing can start over for anyone at any time. It really could. It could start over right now. If the day isn't going the right way, all it takes is a minute to sit down and really think about what the program stands for. Like, whether that's just opening the big book or praying or calling another alcoholic, it could really start over, because AA is like that perspective pill for us that we need to get us out of ourselves and out of the maze of my life, you know. But if you really like pan out, like from where your feet are to the state that you're in, to the country that you're in, and then into the universe, I mean, really, we are winning. We are up. You know, we've got more on our side than most, and we're more fortunate than most, I think. I mean, just having a cell phone, we're up than most.
Yeah. A safe place to lay our head.
Yeah, exactly. And it clothes a vehicle or a job. We get so caught up in the, I hate this job, I hate this job, I hate that car, I hate this person, I hate that meeting. And it's like what it talks about on page 417, 418, and 419 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the acceptance chapter, about how our lenses are just backwards, and we should be working the program in our homes, and we should be looking at what's good in a meeting, or what can I add to the meeting, or what can I do to help another? You know, those pages are big too. Huge for me.
Aren't those pages the stories, or this is after the stories?
Those are the stories. There's a chapter called Acceptance Was the Answer. And on 417, it talks about acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I'm disturbed, it's because I find some person, some place, something being unacceptable to me, and I can find no serenity until I accept it. And that was the same thing for my alcoholism. Until I could accept that I was an alcoholic and that my life was unmanageable, I couldn't get to work. And that's the beginning of working the steps, and then that's the beginning of any situation or a problem. You have to accept it for being the way that it is and start working the solution and not the problem.
Yes. Your grandmother, is she still alive?
My grandmother passed, unfortunately, but lived an incredible life. But she got to die at home, and I was able to be of service and be there for her. And so that was good.
So you were sober?
I was sober. I think I was 2 years sober when she passed.
So what was she doing from 2011 after your mom passed away to 2016 when you got sober, having known where you were at? Like, how did she present the program to her grandson without pushing it?
Right. Well, she didn't have to present it to me. I mean, if you were to walk into there, I got a lot of the stuff from her house when she passed, of my grandfather and her. They had the one day at a time sign as you walked in, you know, the serenity prayer up on a wooden plaque. And I mean, they had a library of AA literature, which I got a good chunk of. And of course their program, Overcomers Outreach. And so it was there. It was me with blinders on. I just wasn't ready to see it. I wasn't ready to, I couldn't understand it. It takes what it takes to surrender. And I just wasn't in that realm of, I was just still like, I'm too young to get sober. And, you know, and I'm not going to have a drink at my wedding. What are you talking? I mean, I wasn't even engaged, but, you know, I'm thinking about my wedding, and it just was all this stupid stuff. And then of course there's the addiction. I was addicted to drugs and alcohol. It was my higher power, and I protected it and was in so much denial about it for so long. And at the end, it became this, I was willing to admit that I was powerless over alcohol, but because of my performing job and getting paid pretty well, I was unwilling to admit that my life was unmanageable, even though it was. I just wasn't ready to admit that. But she did, you know, she took my brother and I in on separate occasions when we were in our disease, and we would get like 30 days, 60 days. When I got home from treatment the first time after relapsing in treatment, she let me stay with her. And I mean, everyone just did the best that they could. And it took what it took for me to surrender finally and to do the steps.
And you said your brother has 5 years on you?
Okay, so he had 5 years on me, and I got sober, and he helped me get sober, and I wouldn't be sober if it wasn't for him. He works for a company called Rock to Recovery, which is this incredible program. They go to a sober residential treatments and hospitals, and they record like a song as their therapy session. Mm-hmm. He still works for them, and he kind of, without going into too much detail about his story, he kind of fell away from the steps, but he's doing great now. He's doing really great. He's got some time now.
Well, you guys both loved your mother very much. You said that she was perfection to us and Christmas to us. And that is so sweet. As a mother of three boys, I hope they say that about me someday.
I'm sure they are.
They love torturing me. Did you guys love pissing your mom off? Because they think it's hilarious to make me mad.
Oh my God, my poor, poor mother. We would go into a department store and run in opposite directions. I mean, what was she supposed to do? Oh man. My dad was so busy with music and helping to provide for the family. You know, she kind of had to deal with the three kids and raise us. And so, I mean, we would not necessarily do it on purpose, but I'm sure we tortured her.
Oh, boys.
Yeah.
I like how you said you were auditing AA too. I think that's hilarious. I'm going to use that.
Oh yeah. Just kind of like being able to walk in to an AA meeting and be like, all right, what do you got? And you know what I mean? Like, you know, walk in and be like, well, we'll see if this will do.
See if they're up to par.
You guys better get some better coffee in here if you want me to come back.
That's right.
You know, thinking that, you know, God, just ego maniac, ego, 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 edging God out.
I love that Jesus is your higher power, but I liked how you said there's this whole idea of just remaining open-minded. And that's the beauty of the program, is we have open-mindedness. And if we didn't have that open-mindedness, our spiritual growth would get stunted, just like you were talking about your program getting stale. When we have an open mind about our higher power, we allow it to grow. In my perception, it's I picked the Jesus team, but I didn't pick roles to go with it. So I get, it's just an open menu of whatever it wants to be. And that prevents it from getting stale.
Yeah. I mean, and also there's a great interview with my grandparents on the Bob Dobson program. It's online. You can listen to it and you can hear my grandparents talk about this, that when they created their program of Overcomers Outreach and Jesus is the higher power, he also goes, my grandpa goes on to say, thank God Bill and Bob didn't make this one higher power, because think of all the people that wouldn't have been saved from alcoholism. Think of all the people that wouldn't have wanted to try it and to find their own way to the end of this thing. And they were so smart in the way that they crafted and worded the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the greatest manual for living for someone like me. It is just, everything is broken down. Every answer that I need is in that book. And it's so great. I mean, just the open-mindedness of this program is so important. So important. Have to have it.
I think it allows us to, we talk about growth and there's continual growth. And my new word that I'm trying out is healing. Like, I have continual healing to be done, because sometimes I'm just exhausted and working all the steps can be exhausting. And I cannot grow today, but I always have energy to heal, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So always room to heal, and love and tolerance of others is our code. And that was just a beautiful share. I really appreciate it. Is there anything that you left out or that you're thinking of now?
If there was like an award that I could give, it would be to like my wife and my family that still has to, I mean, because without solution and without alcohol, I'm crazy. I'm horrible to be around. They get the medal because they're there for when I'm not connected. You know, they're there for better or for worse. And alcoholics, when they're disconnected, are not the greatest people on the planet, especially in early recovery, which I got 7 years of sobriety. I just took 7 years on Wednesday. But I have more experience drugging and drinking than I do with recovery still, because I was drugging and drinking from 17 to 29. And so I hope that when I get 12 years, that hopefully there'll be a little bit more balance. But I mean, I'm just so thankful that God's put people in my life that are patient enough to withstand the storm of growth without drugs and alcohol. Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes sense. My sponsor was just telling me this morning, she said, we alcoholics, we're not the best behaved people.
We're not the bedrock of mental health.
I don't know. Yeah, award to our families for sure. Final question for the alcoholic out there listening, perhaps suffering. What final message would you like to leave with them?
You have to act your way into right thinking. So I know I talked about how it does take what it takes. Like, but sometimes rock bottom is what it takes to get sober. But also sometimes rock bottom could be death, especially for drugs and alcohol. I see it all the time now that I work in treatment. But really, all you have to do is find a meeting and get in the middle which means like get like 30 phone numbers of people that are in the program, get a sponsor and work the steps and try not to think your way out of getting better. Just act your way by going to the meetings and taking the steps. And if you can get to the 12th step, find out if you haven't gotten some peace and serenity by the end of the 12 steps. But really, yeah, try and act your way into right thinking. Because I think a lot of times there's that social anxiety of like, I'm not going to know anybody at a meeting. Or, God, I got to look up a meeting. But everybody goes through that awkward stage, especially without your go-to drugs or alcohol, right? It's like, I got to go sober, meet all these new people. This is a brand new thing. Like I used to always talk about, well, not used to, but I started talking about how in recovery, you go through all your firsts. Like I went through my first fight sober. I went to my first party sober. I went to my first wedding sober. And that first AA meeting, when you're on the fence about whether or not you need to get help, is very scary. But just know that everyone that's in the meeting wants you to be there and that you're the most important person. We need more new people in meetings. We need them to show up so that we can keep this movement going. So I guess that's my last message. That was a little long-winded, but act your way into right thinking. I guess I could have just said that.
That is a good quote. That is a quote. I got it. You have to act your way into right thinking. And I think that's an amazing elaboration of that. And I love the reminder that we have all been in our first meeting. We have all been there. We've all had to walk in the rooms when we had no other hope. And in the rooms, we found hope.
Yeah.
Well, I loved hearing about your grandparents. I think it was so sweet and endearing, and your mom and your brother. And it was a really great share with a lot of love throughout it. So I thank you sincerely, Alex.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.